How did you know that?
George Allman, she said. He's on WMDK from midnight until 4 a.m. His show is about walk-ins and UFOs and psychic powers.
Psychic powers? Really?
Yes. And the conspiracy. Do you know about the conspiracy, son?
Sort of, Luke said.
George Allman's show is called The Outsiders. People call in, but mostly it's just him talking. He doesn't say it's aliens or the government working with aliens. He's careful because he doesn't want to disappear or get shot like Jack and Bobby. But he talks about the black cars all the time. And the experiments. Things that would turn your hair white. Did you know the Son of Sam was a walk-in? No? Well, he was. Then the devil that was inside him walked back out, leaving only a shell. Raise your head, son. That blood's all down your neck, and if it dries before I can get it, I'll have to scrub.
3. The Beeman boys, a pair of great hulking teenagers from the trailer park south of town, showed up at 12:15, well into what was usually Tim's lunch hour. By then, most of the stuff for Fromey's small engine sales and service was on the cracked concrete of the station tarmac. If it had been up to Tim, he would have fired the Beemans on the spot, but they were related to Mr. Jackson in some complicated southern way, so that wasn't an option. Besides, he needed them. Del Beeman got the big truck with the steak sides backed up to the door of the Carolina Produce boxcar by 12:30, and they began loading in crates of lettuce, tomatoes, cucumbers, and summer squash. Hector and his second man, interested not in fresh veggies but only in getting the hell out of South Carolina, pitched in. Norb Hollister stood in the shade of the depot overhang, doing some heavy looking on, but nothing else. Tim found the man's continued presence a trifle peculiar. He'd shown no interest in the arrivals and departures of the trains before, but was too busy to consider it. An old Ford station wagon pulled into the station's small parking lot at 10:50, just as Tim was forklifting the last crates of produce into the back of the truck that would deliver them to the Dupre grocery, assuming that Phil Beeman got it there all right. It was less than a mile. But this morning, Phil's speech was slow, and his eyes were as red as those of a small animal trying to stay ahead of a brush fire. It didn't take Sherlock Holmes to deduce he'd been indulging in a bit of wacky tobacco. He and his brother both. Doc Roper got out of his station wagon. Tim tipped him a wave and pointed to the warehouse where Mr. Jackson kept his office/apartment. Roper waved back and headed in that direction. He was old school. Almost a caricature. The kind of doctor who still survives in 1,000 poor-ass rural areas where the nearest hospital is 40 or 50 miles away, Obamacare is looked upon as a libtard blasphemy, and a trip to Walmart is considered an occasion. He was overweight and over 60, a hard-shell Baptist who carried a Bible as well as a stethoscope in a black bag which had been handed down father to son for 3 generations.
"What's with that kid?" the train's second man asked, using a bandana to mop his forehead.
"I don't know," Tim said, "but I intend to find out. Go on, you guys, rev it up and go, unless you want to leave me one of those Lexuses, Hector. Happy to roll it off myself if you do." "Chupa mi polla," Hector said. Then he shook Tim's hand and headed back to his engine, hoping to make up time between Dupre and Brunswick.
4. Stackhouse intended to make the trip on the Challenger with the 2 extraction teams, but Mrs. Sigsby overruled him. She could do that because she was the boss. Nevertheless, Stackhouse's expression of dismay at this idea bordered on insulting. "Wipe that look off your face," she said. "Whose head do you think will roll if this goes pear-shaped?"
"Both of our heads, and it won't stop with us."
"Yes, but whose will come off first? And roll the farthest?"
"Julia, this is a field operation, and you've never been in the field before."
"I'll have both Ruby and Opal teams with me. 4 good men and 3 tough women. We'll also have Tony Fazeli, who's ex-Marines, Dr. Evans, and Winona Briggs. She's ex-Army and has some triage skills. Denny Williams will be in charge once the operation begins, but I intend to be there, and I intend to write my report from a ground-level perspective. She paused. If there needs to be a report, that is, and I'm starting to believe there will be no way to avoid it. She glanced at her watch. 12:30. No more discussion. We need to get this on wheels. You run the place, and if it all goes well, I'll be back here by 2 tomorrow morning. He walked with her out the door and down to the gated dirt road that eventually led to 2-lane blacktop 3 miles east. The day was hot. Crickets sang in the thick woods through which the fucking kid had somehow found his way. A Ford Windstar soccer mom van was idling in front of the gate, with Robin Lex behind the wheel. Michelle Robertson was sitting beside her. Both women wore jeans and black t-shirts. From here to Presque Isle, Mrs. Sigsby said, 90 minutes. From Presque Isle to Erie, Pennsylvania, another 70 minutes. We pick up Opaltine there. From Erie to Alkaloo, South Carolina, 2 hours, give or take. If all goes well, we'll be in Dupre by 7 this evening.
Stay in touch, and remember that Williams is in charge once you go hot, not you.
I will.
Julia, I really think this is a mistake. It ought to be me.
She faced him. Say it again, and I'll haul off on you. She walked to the van.
Denny Williams unrolled the side door for her. Mrs. Sigsby started to get in, then turned to Stackhouse.
And make sure Avery Dixon is well dunked and in back half by the time I return.
Donkey Kong doesn't like the idea.
She gave him a terrifying smile.
Do I look like I care?
5. Tim watched the train pull out, then returned to the shade of the depot's overhang. His shirt was soaked with sweat. He was surprised to see Norbert Hollister still standing there. As usual, he was wearing his paisley vest and dirty khakis, today cinched with a braided belt just below his breastbone. Tim wondered, and not for the first time, how he could wear pants that high and not squash the hell out of his balls.
What are you still doing here, Norbert?
Hollister shrugged and smiled, revealing teeth Tim could have done without viewing before lunch.
Just passing the time. Afternoons ain't exactly busy back at the old ranchero.
As if mornings or evenings were, Tim thought.
Well, why don't you put an egg in your shoe and beat it?
Norbert pulled a pouch of Red Man from his back pocket and stuffed some in his mouth. It went a long way, Tim thought, to explaining the color of his teeth.
Who died and made you pope?
I guess that sounded like a request, Tim said.
It wasn't.
Go.
Fine, fine. I can take a hint. You have a good day, Mr. Nightknocker.
Norbert ambled off. Tim looked after him, frowning. He sometimes saw Hollister in Bev's eatery, or down at Zoni's, buying boiled peanuts or a hard-boiled egg out of the jar on the counter. But otherwise, he rarely left his motel office, where he watched sports and porn on his satellite TV, which, unlike the ones in the rooms, worked. Orphan Annie was waiting for Tim in Mr. Jackson's outer office, sitting behind the desk and thumbing through the papers in Jackson's in-out basket.
That's not your business, Annie, Tim said mildly. And if you mess that stuff up, I'll be the one in trouble.
Nothing interesting anyway, she said. Just invoices and schedules and such. Although he does have a meal punch card for that topless cafe down Hardyville. 2 more punches and he gets a free buffet lunch. Although eating lunch while looking at some woman snatchola.
Tim had never thought of it that way, and now that he had, wished he hadn't.
The doc's in with a kid?
Yeah, I stopped the bleeding, but he'll have to wear his hair long from now on because that ear's never going to look the same. Now listen to me. That boy's parents were murdered, and he was kidnapped.
Part of the conspiracy? He and Annie had had many conversations about the conspiracy on his night-knocker rounds.
That's right. They came for him in the black cars. Count on it. And if they trace him to here, they'll come for him here.
Noted, he said. And I'll be sure to discuss it with Sheriff John. Thanks for cleaning him up and watching him, but now I think you better head out. She got up and shook out her serape.
That's right. You tell Sheriff John. You all need to be on your guard. They're apt to come locked and loaded. There's a town in Maine, Jerusalem's Lot, and you could ask the people who live there about the men in the black cars. If you could find any people, that is. They all disappeared 40 or more years ago. George Allman talks about that town all the time.
Got it. She went to the door, serape swishing, then turned.
You don't believe me? And I ain't a bit surprised. Why would I be? I've been the town weirdo for years before you came. And if the Lord doesn't take me, I'll be the town weirdo years after you're gone.
Annie, I never...
Hush.
She stared at him fiercely from beneath her sombrero.
It's all right, but pay attention now. I'm telling you, but he told me. That boy. So that's two of us, all right? And you remember what I said. They come in black cars.
6. Doc Roper was putting the few tools of examination he'd used back into his bag. The boy was still sitting in Mr. Jackson's easy chair. His face had been cleaned of blood and his ear was bandaged. He was raising a good bruise down the right side of his face from his argument with the signal post. But his eyes were clear and alert. The doc had found a bottle of ginger ale in the little fridge, and the boy was making short work of it.
Sit there easy, young man, Roper said.
He snapped his bag shut and walked over to Tim, who was standing just inside the door to the outer office. Is he okay? Tim asked, keeping his voice low.
He's dehydrated, and he's hungry. He hasn't had much to eat in quite a while, but otherwise he seems fine to me. Kids his age bounce back from worse. He says he's 12. He says his name is Nick Wilhelm. And he says he got on the train where it started, way up in northern Maine. I ask him what he was doing there. He says he can't tell me. I ask him for his address. He says he can't remember. Plausible. A hard knock on the head can cause temporary disorientation and scrambled memory. But I've been around the block a few times, and I can tell the difference between amnesia and reticence, especially in a kid. He's hiding something. Maybe a lot.
Okay.
My advice? Promise to feed him a big old meal at the cafe, and you'll get the whole story.
Thanks, Doc. Send me the bill. Roper waved this away.
You buy me a big old meal someplace classier than Bev's, and we'll call it Squire.
In the doc's thick Dixie accent, square came out squar.
And when you get his story, I want to hear it.
When he was gone, Tim closed the door so it was just him and the boy and took his cell phone from his pocket. He called Bill Wicklow, the deputy who was scheduled to take over the night knocker's job after Christmas. The boy watched him closely, finishing the last of his cold drink. Bill, this is Tim. Yeah, fine. Just wondering if you'd like a little dry run on the night-knocking job tonight. This is usually my time to sleep, but something's come up down at the train yard. He listened. Excellent. I owe you one. I'll leave the time clock at the cop shop. Don't forget you have to wind it up. And thanks. He ended the call and studied the boy. The bruises on his face would bloom, then fade in a week or two. The look in his eyes might take longer. You feeling better? Headache going away? Yes, sir. Never mind the sir. You can call me Tim. Now, what do I call you? What's your real name? After a brief hesitation, Luke told him. 7. The poorly lit tunnel between front half and back half was chilly. And Avery began to shiver immediately. He still had on the clothes he'd been wearing when Zeke and Carlos had hauled his small unconscious body out of the immersion tank, and he was soaked. His teeth began to chatter. Still, he held on to what he had learned.
It was important. Everything was important now.
Stop with the teeth, Gladys said. That's a disgusting sound.
She was pushing him in a wheelchair, her smile nowhere in evidence. Word of what this little shit had done was everywhere now, and like all the other Institute employees, she was terrified and would remain so until Luke Ellis was hauled back and they could all breathe a sigh of relief.
I can't help it, Avery said. I'm so cold. Do you think I give a shit?
Gladys's raised voice echoed back from the tile walls. Do you have any idea of what you did? Do you have any idea? Avery did. In fact, he had many ideas. Some of them Gladys's. Her fear was like a rat running on a wheel in the middle of her head. Some of them entirely his own. Once they were through the door marked authorized personnel only, it was a little warmer. And in the tatty lounge where Dr. James was waiting for them, her white lab coat misbuttoned, her hair in disarray, a big goofy smile on her face, it was warmer still. Avery's shivering slowed, then ceased, but the colored Stasi lights came back. That was all right, because he could make them go away any time he wanted. Zeke had nearly killed him in that tank. In fact, before Avery passed out, he thought he was dead. But the tank had also done something to him. He understood that it did stuff to some of the other kids who went into it, but he thought this was something more. TK as well as TP was the least of it. Gladys was terrified of what might happen because of Luke, but Avery had an idea that he, Avery, could terrify her of him if he wanted. But this wasn't the time.
Hello, young man,
Dr. James cried. She sounded like a politician on a TV ad, and her thoughts were flying around like scraps of paper caught in a strong wind. Something is really, really wrong with her, Avery thought. It's like radiation poisoning, only in her brain instead of her bones.
Hello,
Avery said. Dr. Jekyll threw back her head and laughed as if hello were the punchline of the funniest joke she'd ever heard.
We weren't expecting you so soon, but welcome, welcome. Some of your friends are here.
I know, Avery thought, and I can't wait to see them. And I think they'll be glad to see me.
First, though, we need to get you out of those wet clothes.
She gave Gladys a reproachful look, but Gladys was busy scratching at her arms, trying to get rid of the buzz running over her skin, or just under it. Good luck with that, Avery thought.
I'll have Henry take you to your room. We have nice caretakers here. Can you walk on your own?
Yes. Dr. Jekyll did some more laughing, head back and throat working. Avery got out of the wheelchair and gave Gladys a long, measuring look. She stopped scratching, and now she was the one who shivered. Not because she was wet, and not because she was cold. It was because of him. She felt him, and she didn't like it. But Avery did. It was sort of beautiful.
8. Because there was no other chair in Mr. Jackson's living room, Tim brought one in from the outer office. He considered putting it in front of the boy, then decided that would be too much like the setup in a police interrogation room. He slid it beside the lazy boy instead, sitting next to the boy the way you'd sit with a friend, maybe to watch a favorite TV show. Only Mr. Jackson's flat screen was blank. Now, Luke, he said, according to Annie, you were kidnapped. But Annie isn't always completely on the beam, let's say.
She's on the beam about that, Luke said.
Okay, then. Kidnapped from where?
Minneapolis. They knocked me out, and they killed my parents.
He swiped a hand across his eyes. These kidnappers took you from Minneapolis to Maine. How did they do that?
I don't know. I was unconscious, probably in a plane. I really am from Minneapolis. You can check that out. All you have to do is call my school. It's called the Broderick School for Exceptional Children.
Which would make you a bright boy, I'm assuming.
Oh, sure, Luke said with no pride in his voice. I'm a bright boy. And right now, I'm a very hungry boy. I haven't had anything for a couple of days but a sausage biscuit and a fruit pie. I think a couple of days. I've kind of lost track of time. A man named Maddie gave them to me.
Nothing else?
A piece of donut, Luke said. It wasn't very big. Jesus, let's get you something to eat.
Yes, Luke said, then added, please.
Tim took his cell phone from his pocket. Wendy, this is Tim. I wonder if you could do me a favor.
9.
Avery's room in back half was stark. The bed was your basic cot. There were no Nickelodeon posters on the walls and no G.I. Joes on the bureau to play with. That was okay with Avery. He was only 10, but now he had to be a grown-up, and grown-ups didn't play with toy soldiers. Only I can't do it alone, he thought. He remembered Christmas the year before. It hurt to think about that, but he thought about it anyway. He had gotten the Lego castle he'd asked for, but when the pieces were spread out before him, he didn't know how to get from that scatter to the beautiful castle on the box, with its turrets and gates and the drawbridge that went up and down. He'd started to cry. Then his father, dead now, he was sure of it, knelt down beside him and said, "We'll follow the instructions and do it together, one step at a time." And they had. The castle had stayed on his bureau in his room with his G.I. Joes guarding it, and that castle was one thing they hadn't been able to duplicate when he woke up in front half. Now he lay on the cot in this barren room, dressed in dry clothes, thinking of how fine the castle had looked when it was done, and feeling the hum. It was constant here in back half. Loud in the rooms, louder in the halls, loudest of all down past the cafeteria, where a double-locked door beyond the caretaker's break room led to the back half of back half. The caretakers often called that part Gorky Park, because the kids who lived there, if you could call it living, were gorks, hummers. But they were useful, Avery supposed. The way the wrapper your Hershey bar came in was useful, until you licked it clean. Then you could throw it away. The doors here had locks. Avery concentrated, trying to turn his. Not that there was anywhere to go except for the hallway with its blue carpet, but it was an interesting experiment. He could feel the lock trying to turn, but he couldn't quite manage it. He wondered if George Iris would be able to, because George had been a strong TK Paz to begin with. Avery guessed he could, with a little help. He thought again about what his father had said. We'll do it together, one step at a time. At 5 o'clock, the door opened and a red-clad caretaker poked his unsmiling face in. They didn't wear name tags here, but Avery didn't need a name tag. This was Jacob, known to his colleagues as Jake the Snake. He was ex-Navy. You tried to be a SEAL, Avery thought, but you couldn't make it. They kicked you out. I think maybe you liked hurting people too much.
Dinner, Jake the Snake said. If you want it, come on. If you don't, I'll lock you in until movie time.
I want it.
All right. You like movies, kiddo?
Yes, Avery said, and thought, but I won't like these. These movies kill people.
You'll like these, Jake said. There's always a cartoon to start with. Calf's right down there on your left, and quit lollygagging.
Jake gave him a hefty swat on the ass to get him going. In the cafeteria, a dreary room painted the same dark green as the residence corridor in front half, about a dozen kids sat eating what smelled to Avery like Dinty Moore beef stew. His mom served it at least twice a week back home, because his little sister liked it. She was probably dead, too. Most of the kids looked like zombies, and there was a lot of slobbering. He saw one kid, a girl, who was smoking a cigarette as she ate. As Avery watched, she tapped ash into her bowl, looked around vacantly, and began eating from it again. He had felt Kalisha even down in the tunnel, and now he saw her, sitting at a table near the back. He had to restrain an urge to run to her and throw his arms around her neck. That would attract attention, and Avery didn't want to do that. Just the opposite. Helen Sims was sitting next to Shaw, hands lying limply on either side of her bowl. Her eyes were fixed on the ceiling. Her hair, so razzly colored when she showed up in front half, was now dull and dank,
hanging around her face, her much thinner face, in clumps. Kalisha was feeding her, or trying to.
Come on, Hell. Come on, Hell on Wheels. Here we go.
Shaw got a spoonful of the stew into Helen's mouth. When a brown lump of mystery meat tried to come out over Helen's lower lip, Shaw used the spoon to push it back in. This time Helen swallowed, and Shaw smiled.
That's right. Good.
Shaw, Avery thought.
Hey, Kalisha!
She looked around, startled, saw him, and broke into a broad smile.
Avester!
A drool of brown gravy ran down Helen's chin. Nikki, sitting on her other side, used a paper napkin to wipe it off. Then he also saw Avery, grinned, and gave him a thumbs up. George, sitting directly across from Nikki, turned around.
Hey, check it out, it's the Avester, George said.
Shaw thought you might be coming. Welcome to our happy home, little hero.
If you're gonna eat, get a bowl,
said a hard-faced older woman. Her name was Corinne, Avery knew, and she liked slapping. Slapping made her feel good.
I gotta shut down early on account of its movie night.
Avery got a bowl and ladled up some of the stew. Yes, it was Dinty Moore. He put a piece of spongy white bread on top of it, then took his meal over to his friends and sat down. Shaw smiled at him. Her headache was bad today, but she smiled anyway, and that made him feel like laughing and crying at the same time.
Eat up, buddy, Nikki said.
But he wasn't taking his own advice. His bowl was still mostly full. His eyes were bloodshot, and he was rubbing at his left temple.
I know it looks like diarrhea, but you don't want to go to the movies on an empty stomach.
Have they caught Luke? Shaw sent. No, they're all scared shitless. Good. Good. Will we get hurty shots before the movie?
I don't think so tonight. This is still a new one. We've only seen it once.
George was looking at them with wise eyes. He had heard. Once upon a front half time, George Iris had only been a TK, but now he was something more. They all were. Back half increased whatever you had, but thanks to the immersion tank, none of them were like Avery. He knew stuff. The tests in front half, for example. A lot of them were side projects of Dr. Hendricks, but the injections were matters of practicality. Some of them were limiters, and Avery hadn't had those. He had gone straight to the immersion tank, where he had been taken to death's door, or maybe right through it. And as a result, he could make the Stasi lights almost any time he wanted to. He didn't need the movies, and he didn't need to be part of the groupthink. Creating that groupthink was back half's main job. But he was still only 10, which was a problem. As he began to eat, he probed for Helen, and was delighted to discover she was still in there. He liked Helen. She wasn't like that bitch Frida. He didn't need to read Frida's mind to know she had tricked him into telling her stuff, then snitched on him. Who else could it have been?
Helen? No, don't talk to me, Avery. I have to...
The rest was gone, but Avery thought he understood. She had to hide. There was a sponge filled with pain inside her head, and she was hiding from it as best she could. Hiding from pain was a sensible response, as far as it went. The problem was how the sponge kept swelling. It would keep on until there was nowhere to hide, and then it would squash her against the back of her own skull like a fly on a wall. Then she'd be done. As Helen, at least. Avery reached into her mind. It was easier than trying to turn the lock on the door of his room, because he'd been a powerful TP to begin with, and TK was new to him. He was clumsy and had to be careful. He couldn't fix her, but he thought he could ease her. Shield her a bit. That would be good for her, and it would be good for them, because they were going to need all the help they could get. He found the headache sponge deep inside Helen's head. He told it to stop spreading. He told it to go away. It didn't want to. He pushed it. The colored lights started to appear in front of him, swirling slowly,
like cream into coffee. He pushed harder. The sponge was pliable but firm.
Kalisha, help me.
With what? What are you doing?
He told her.
She came in, tentatively at first. They pushed together. The headache sponge gave a little.
George, Avery sent. Nikki, help us.
Nikki was able to, a little. George looked puzzled at first, then joined in. But after a moment, he backed out again.
I can't, he whispered. It's dark. Never mind the dark.
That was Shaw.
I think we can help.
George came back. He was reluctant, and he wasn't much help, but at least he was with them.
It's only a sponge, Avery told them.
He could no longer see his bowl of stew. It had been replaced by the heartbeat swirl of the Stasi lights.
It can't hurt you. Push it. All together.
They tried, and something happened. Helen looked down from the ceiling. She looked at Avery instead.
Look who's here, she said in a rusty voice. My headache's a little better. Thank God.
She began to eat on her own.
Holy shit, George said.
That was us. Nick was grinning and holding up a hand. Five, Avery. Avery slapped him five. But any good feeling left with the dots. Helen's headache would come back, and it would worsen each time she watched the movies. Helen's would, Shaw's would, Nikki's would. His would, too. Eventually, all of them would join the hum emanating from Gorky Park. But maybe, if they were all together in their own groupthink, and if there was a way to make a shield.
Shaw.
She looked at him. She listened. Nikki and George also listened, at least as well as they could. It was like they were partially deaf. But Shaw heard. She ate a bite of stew, then put her spoon down and shook her head.
We can't escape, Avery.
If that's what you're thinking, forget it.
I know we can't, but we have to do something. We have to help Luke, and we have to help ourselves. I see the pieces, but I don't know how to put them together. I don't...
You don't know how to build the castle, Nikki said in a low, musing voice.
Helen had stopped eating again and had resumed her inspection of the ceiling. The headache sponge was growing again already, swelling as it gorged on her mind. Nikki helped her to another bite.
Cigarettes!
One of the caretakers was shouting. He held up a box. Smokes were free back here, it seemed. Encouraged, even.
Who wants a cigarette before the show?
We can't escape, Avery sent. So help me build a castle. A wall. A shield. Our castle. Our wall. Our shield.
He looked from Shaw to Nikki to George, and back to Shaw again, pleading for her to understand. Her eyes brightened.
She gets it, Avery thought. Thank God, she gets it.
She started to speak, but closed her mouth again as the caretaker, his name was Clint, passed them by, bawling.
Cigarettes! Who wants one before the show?
When he was gone, she said, If we can't escape, we have to take the place over. 10.
Deputy Wendy Gullickson's original frosty attitude toward Tim had warmed considerably since their first date at the Mexican restaurant in Hardyville. They were now an acknowledged couple, and when she came into Mr. Jackson's back room apartment with a large paper bag, she kissed him first on the cheek and then quickly on the mouth.
This is Deputy Gullickson, Tim said, but you can call her Wendy if that's okay with her.
It is,
Wendy said.
What's your name?
Luke looked to Tim, who gave him a slight nod.
Luke Ellis? Pleased to meet you, Luke. That's quite a bruise you got there.
Yes, ma'am.
Ran into something.
Yes, Wendy.
And the bandage over your ear? Did you cut yourself as well?
That made him smile a little, because it was the stone truth.
Something like that. Tim said you might be hungry, so I grabbed some takeout from the restaurant on Main Street. I've got a Coca-Cola, chicken, burgers, and fries. What do you want?
All of it, Luke said, which made Wendy and Tim laugh. They watched him eat two drumsticks, then a hamburger, and most of the fries. Finally, a good-sized go-cup of rice pudding. Tim, who had missed his lunch, ate the rest of the chicken and drank a Coke. All right now? Tim asked when the food was gone. Instead of speaking, Luke burst into tears. Wendy hugged him and stroked his hair, working some of the tangles out with her fingers. When Luke's sobs finally eased, Tim squatted beside him.
Sorry, Luke said. Sorry.
That's okay, you're allowed.
It's because I feel alive again, and I don't know why that would make me cry, but it did. I think it's called relief, Wendy said.
Luke claims his parents were murdered and he was kidnapped, Tim said. Wendy's eyes widened.
It's not a claim,
Luke said, sitting forward in Mr. Jackson's easy chair.
It's the truth.
Bad word choice, maybe. Let's have your story, Luke. Luke considered this, then said,
Will you do something for me first?
If I can, Tim said.
Look outside. See if that other guy is still there.
Norbert Hollister? Tim smiled. I told him to scram. By now, he's probably down at the Go-Mart buying lottery tickets. He's convinced he's going to be South Carolina's next millionaire.
Just check.
Tim looked at Wendy, who shrugged and said,
I'll do it.
She came back a minute later, frowning.
As a matter of fact, he's sitting in a rocking chair over at the depot, reading a magazine. I think he's an uncle, Luke said in a low voice. I had uncles in Richmond and Wilmington, maybe in Sturbridge, too. I never knew I had so many uncles.
He laughed. It was a metallic sound. Tim got up and went to the door just in time to see Norbert Hollister rise and amble away in the direction of his going-to-seed motel. He didn't look back. Tim returned to Luke and Wendy. He's gone, son.
Maybe to call them,
Luke said. He poked at his empty Coke can.
I won't let them take me back. I thought I was going to die there.
Where? Tim asked.
The Institute. Start at the beginning and tell us everything, Wendy said.
Luke did. 11. When he was finished, it took almost half an hour, and Luke consumed a second Coke during the telling. There was a moment of silence. Then Tim said, very quietly, It's not possible. Just to begin with, that many abductions would raise red flags. Wendy shook her head at that.
You were a cop. You should know better. There was a study a few years back that said over 500,000 kids go missing each year in the United States. Pretty staggering figure, wouldn't you say?
I know the numbers are high. There were almost 500 missing kids reported in Sarasota County the last year I was on the cops there. But the majority, the great majority, are kids who come back on their own. Tim was thinking of Robert and Roland Bilson, the twins he'd spotted on their way to the Dunning Agricultural Fair in the wee hours of the morning.
That still leaves thousands, she said. Tens of thousands.
Agreed, but how many of those disappear leaving murdered parents behind?
No idea. I doubt if anyone's done a study.
She turned her attention back to Luke, who had been following their conversation with his eyes, as if watching a tennis match. His hand was in his pocket, touching the thumb drive as if it were a lucky rabbit's foot. Sometimes, he said, they probably make it look like accidents. Tim had a sudden vision of this boy living with Orphan Annie in her tent, the two of them listening to that late-night kook of hers on the radio, talking about the conspiracy, talking about they.
You say you cut your earlobe off because there was a tracking device in it? Wendy said. Is that really the truth, Luke?
Yes. Wendy didn't seem to know where to take it from there. The expression she looked at Tim said,
Over to you.
Tim picked up Luke's empty Coke can and dropped it into the takeout bag, which now contained nothing but wrappers and chicken bones. You're talking
about a secret installation running a secret program on domestic soil, one that stretches back God knows how many years. Once upon a time, that might have been possible, I suppose, theoretically. But not in the age of the computer. The government's biggest secrets get dumped onto the internet by this rogue outfit called
WikiLeaks. I know about WikiLeaks.
Luke sounded impatient.
I know how hard it is to keep secrets, and I know how crazy this sounds. On the other hand, the Germans had concentration camps during World War II, where they managed to kill 7 million Jews, also gypsies and gays. But the people around those camps knew what was going on, Wendy said.
She tried to take his hand. Luke took it back.
And I'd bet $1 million the people in Denison Riverbend, that's the closest town, know something's going on, something bad. Not what, because they don't want to know. Why would they? It keeps them going, and besides, who'd believe it anyway? You've still got people who don't believe the Germans killed all those Jews, as far as that goes. It's called denial.
Yes, Tim thought. The boy is bright. His cover story for whatever really happened to him is loony, but he does have a ton of brains.
I want to be sure I have this straight,
Wendy said. She was speaking gently. They both were. Luke got it. You didn't have to be a child-fucking prodigy to know this was how people talk to someone who was mentally unbalanced. He was disappointed, but not surprised. What else could he have expected?
They somehow find kids who are telepaths, and what you call telekinetics, TK.
Usually the talents are small. Even TK Paws kids don't have much. But the Institute doctors make them stronger. Shots for dots, that's what they say. What we all say, only the dots are really the Stasi lights I told you about. The shots that bring on the lights are supposed to boost what we have. I think some of the others might be to make us last longer, or, here was something he just thought of, or to keep us from getting too much, which could make us dangerous to them. Like vaccinations? Tim asked.
I guess you could say that, yeah.
Before you were taken, you could move objects with your mind. Tim said in his gentle, I'm talking to a lunatic voice.
Small objects.
And since the near-death experience in the immersion tank, you can also read thoughts.
Even before. The tank boosted it higher. But I'm still not...
He massaged the back of his neck. This was hard to explain, and their voices, so low and so calm, were getting on his nerves, which were already raw. Soon he would be as nuts as they thought he was. Still, he had to try. But I'm still not very strong. None of us are, except maybe for Avery. He's awesome. Tim said,
Let me make sure I have this straight. They kidnap kids who have weak psychic powers, feed them mental steroids, then get them to kill people. Like that politician who was planning to run for president, Mark Berkowitz.
Yes. Why not Bin Laden?
Wendy asked.
I would have thought he'd be a natural target for this mental assassination. I don't know,
Luke said. He sounded exhausted. The bruise on his cheek seemed to be growing more colorful by the minute.
I don't have a clue how they pick their targets. I talked about it one time with my friend Kalisha. She didn't have any idea either. Why wouldn't this mystery organization just use Hitman? Wouldn't that be simpler?
It looks simple in the movies, Luke said. In real life, I think they mostly fail or get caught, like the guys who killed Bin Laden almost got caught.
Let's have a demonstration, Tim said. I'm thinking of a number. Tell me what it is.
Luke tried. He concentrated and waited for the colored dots to appear. But they didn't come.
I can't get it.
Move something, then. Isn't that your basic talent, the one they grabbed you for?
Wendy shook her head. Tim was no telepath, but he knew what she was thinking.
Stop badgering him. He's disturbed and disoriented and on the run.
But Tim thought if he could break through the kid's cockamamie story, maybe they could get to something real and figure out where to go from there.
How about the takeout bag? No food in it now. It's light. You should be able to move it.
Luke looked at it, his brow furrowing more deeply. For a moment, Tim thought he felt something. a whisper along his skin like a faint draft. But then it was gone, and the bag didn't move. Of course it didn't.
Okay,
Wendy said.
I think that's enough, for I know you two are boyfriend and girlfriend,
Luke said.
I know that much.
Tim smiled. Not too impressive, kiddo. You saw her kiss me when she came in. Luke turned his attention to Wendy.
You're going on a trip. To see your sister, is it?
Her eyes went wide.
How?
Don't fall for it, Tim said, but gently. It's an old medium's trick. The educated guess. Although I'll admit the kid does it well.
What education have I had about Wendy's sister?
Luke asked, although without much hope. He had played his cards one by one, and now there was only one left. And he was so tired. What sleep he'd gotten on the train had been thin and haunted by bad dreams, mostly of the immersion tank.
Will you excuse us for a minute? Tim asked.
Without waiting for a reply, he took Wendy over to the door to the outer office. He spoke to her briefly. She nodded and left the room, taking her phone from her pocket as she went. Tim came back.
I think we better take you to the station.
At first, Luke thought he was talking about the train station, putting him on another freight, so he and his girlfriend didn't have to deal with the runaway kid and his crazy story. Then he realized that wasn't the kind of station Tim meant.
Oh, so what? Luke thought. I always knew I'd end up in a police station somewhere. And maybe a small one is better than a big one, where they'd have 100 different people, perps, to deal with.
Only they thought he was just being paranoid about that guy Hollister, and that wasn't good. For now, he'd have to hope they were right, and Hollister was nobody special. They probably were right. After all, the Institute couldn't have guys everywhere, could they?
Okay, but first I need to tell you something and show you something.
Go for it, Tim said.
He leaned forward, looking intently into Luke's face. Maybe he was just humoring the crazy kid, but at least he was listening, and Luke supposed that was the best he could expect for now.
If they know I'm here, they'll come for me, probably with guns, because they're scared to death someone might believe me.
Duly noted, Tim said, but we've got a pretty good little police force here, Luke. I think you'll be safe.
You have no idea what you might be up against, Luke thought, but he couldn't try to convince this guy any more just now. He was just too worn out.
Wendy came back and gave Tim a nod. Luke was too beat to care about that either.
The woman who helped me escape from the Institute gave me two things. One was the knife I used to cut off the part of my ear that had the tracker in it. The other was this.
From his pocket, he drew out the flash drive.
I don't know what's on it, but I think you should look at it before you do anything else.
He handed it to Tim.
12. The residents of Back Half, the front half of Back Half, that was, the 18 currently in Gorky Park remained behind their locked door, humming away, were given 20 minutes of free time before the movie started. Jimmy Cullum zombie-walked his aching head to his room. Hal, Donna, and Len sat in the cafeteria, the two boys staring at their half-eaten desserts, chocolate pudding tonight, Donna regarding a smoldering cigarette she seemed to have forgotten how to smoke. Kalisha, Nick, George, Avery, and Helen went down to the lounge with its ugly thrift store furniture and the old flat screen, which showed only prehistoric sitcoms like Bewitched and Happy Days. Katie Givens was there. She didn't look around at them, only at the currently blank TV. To Kalisha's surprise, they were joined by Iris, who looked better than she had in days. Brighter. Kalisha was thinking hard, and she could think because she felt better than she had in days. What they had done to Helen's headache, Avery mostly, but they had all pitched in, had helped her own. The same was true of Nikki and George. She could see it. Take the place over. A bold and delicious idea. But questions immediately arose. The most obvious was how they were supposed to do it, when there were at least 12 caretakers on duty. There were always more on movie days. The second was why they had never thought of this before.
I did, Nikki told her. And was his mental voice stronger? She thought it was. And she thought Avery might have also played a part in that, because he was stronger now. I thought about it when they first brought me here. That was as much as Nikki could manage to tell her mind to mind, so he put his mouth to her ear and whispered the rest.
I was the one who always fought, remember?
It was true. Nikki with his black eyes. Nikki with his bruised mouth.
We're not strong enough, he murmured. Even in here, even after the lights, we only have little powers.
Avery, meanwhile, was looking at Kalisha with desperate hope. He was thinking into her head, but hardly needed to. His eyes said it all.
Here are the pieces, Shaw. I'm pretty sure all of them are here. Help me put them together. Help me build a castle where we can be safe, at least for a while.
Shaw thought of the old faded Hillary Clinton sticker on the back bumper of her mom's Subaru. It said, "Stronger Together." And of course, that was how it worked here in Back Half. That was why they watched the movies together. That was why they could reach across thousands of miles, sometimes even halfway around the world, to the people who were in the movies. If the five of them, make it six if they could work on Iris's headache the way they had worked on Helen's, were able to create that united mental force, a kind of Vulcan mind meld, shouldn't that be enough to mutiny and take Back Half over?
It's a great idea, but I don't think so, George said. He took her hand and gave it a brief squeeze.
We might be able to screw with their heads a little, maybe scare the hell out of them, but they've got those zap sticks, and as soon as they jolted one or two of us, it would be game over.
Kalisha didn't want to admit it, but told him he was probably right.
Avery, one step at a time.
Iris said,
I can't hear what you guys are thinking. I know you're thinking something, but my head still hurts bad.
Avery, let's see what we can do for her. All of us, together.
Kalisha looked at Nick, who nodded. At George, who shrugged and also nodded. Avery led them into Iris Stanhope's head like an explorer leading his party into a cave. The sponge in her mind was very big. Avery saw it as blood-colored, so they all saw it that way. They ranged themselves around it and began to push. It gave a little, and a little more, but then it stopped, resisting their efforts. George backed out first, then Helen, who hadn't had all that much to contribute anyway, then Nick and Kalisha. Avery came last, dealing the headache sponge a petulant mental kick before withdrawing.
Any better, Iris? Kalisha asked, without much hope.
What's better?
It was Katie Givens. She had drifted to join them.
My headache, Iris said. And it is. A little, anyway.
She smiled at Katie, and for a moment the girl who had won the Abilene Spelling Bee was in the room. Katie turned her attention back to the TV.
Where's Richie Cunningham and the Fawns?
She asked, and began rubbing at her temples.
I wish mine was better. My headache hurts like poop.
You see the problem, George thought to the others.
Kalisha did. They were stronger together, yes, but still not strong enough. No more than Hillary Clinton had been when she ran for president a few years back. Because the guy running against her and his supporters had had the political equivalent of the caretaker's zap sticks.
It helped me, though, Helen said. My own headache is almost gone. It's like a miracle.
Don't worry, Nikki said. Hearing him sound so defeated scared Kalisha. It'll be back. Corinne, the caretaker who liked to slap, came into the room. She had one hand on her holstered zap stick as if she had felt something. Probably did, Kalisha thought, but she doesn't know what it was.
Movie time, she said. Come on, kiddies, move your asses.
13. Two caretakers, Jake and Phil, known respectively as the Snake and the Pill, were standing outside the screening room's open doors, each holding a basket. As the kids filed in, those with cigarettes and matches, lighters weren't allowed in Back Half, deposited them in the baskets.
They could have them back when the show was over, if they remembered to take them, that was. Hal, Donna, and Len sat in the back row, staring vacantly at the blank screen. Katie Givens sat in a middle row next to Jimmy Cullum, who was lackadaisically picking his nose. Kalisha, Nick, George, Helen, Iris, and Avery sat down front.
"Welcome to another fun-filled evening," Nikki said in a loud announcer's voice. "This year's feature, an Academy Award winner in the category of Shittiest Documentary,"
Phil the Pill slapped him across the back of the head.
"Shut up, asshole, and enjoy the show."
He retreated. The lights went down, and Dr. Hendricks appeared on the screen. Just seeing the unlit sparkler in his hand made Kalisha's mouth dry up. There was something she was missing, some vital piece of Avery's castle. But it wasn't lost, she just wasn't seeing it. Stronger together, but not strong enough. Even if those poor almost gorks like Jimmy and Hal and Donna were with us, we wouldn't be. But we could be. On nights when the sparkler is lit, we are. When the sparkler is lit, we're destroyers, so what am I missing?
"Welcome, boys and girls," Dr. Hendricks was saying. "And thank you for helping us. Let's begin with a few laughs, shall we? And I'll see you later."
He wagged the unlit sparkler and actually winked. It made Kalisha feel like vomiting. If we can reach all the way to the other side of the world, then why can't we? For a moment, she almost had it. But then Katie gave a loud cry, not of pain or sorrow, but of joy.
"Roadrunner, he's the best!"
She began to sing in a half-screaming falsetto that drilled into Kalisha's brain.
"Roadrunner, Roadrunner, the coyote's after you! Roadrunner, Roadrunner, if he catches you, you're through!"
"Shut it, Cates," George said, not unkindly, and as Roadrunner went meep-meeping down a deserted desert highway, and as Wile E. Coyote looked at him and saw a Thanksgiving dinner, Kalisha felt whatever had almost been in her grasp float away. When the cartoon was over and Wile E. Coyote had once more been vanquished, a guy in a suit came on the screen. He had a microphone in his hand. Kalisha thought he was a businessman, and maybe he was, sort of, but that wasn't his main claim to fame. He was really a preacher man, because when the camera drew back, you could see a big old cross behind him outlined in red neon. And when the camera panned away, you could see an arena, or maybe it was a sports stadium, filled with thousands of people. They rose to their feet, some waving their hands back and forth in the air, some waving Bibles. At first he did a regular sermon, citing chapters and verses from the Bible, but then he got off onto how the country was falling apart because of opioids and fornication. Then it was politics and judges and how America was a shining city on a hill that the godless wanted to smirch with mud. He was starting about how sorcery had bewitched the people of Samaria. What that had to do with America was unclear to Kalisha. But then, the colored dots came, flashing on and off. The hum rose and fell. Kalisha could even feel it in her nose, vibrating the tiny hairs in there. When the dots cleared, they saw the preacher man getting on an airplane with a woman who was probably Mrs. Preacher Man. The dots came back. The hum rose and fell. Kalisha heard Avery in her head, something that sounded like, "They see it. Who sees it?" Avery didn't answer, probably because he was getting into the movie. That was what the Stasi lights did. They got you into it big time. Preacher Man was hitting it again, hitting it hard, this time from the back of a flatbed truck using a bullhorn. Sign said, "Houston loves you," and "God gave Noah the rainbow sign," and John 3:16. Then the dots. And the hum. Several of the empty movie theater seats began to flap up and down by themselves, like unmoored shutters in a strong wind. The screening room doors flew open. Jake the Snake and Phil the Pill slammed them shut again, putting their shoulders into it. Now the preacher man was in some kind of homeless shelter, wearing a cook's apron and stirring a huge vat of spaghetti sauce. His wife was by his side,
both of them grinning, and this time it was Nick in her head. Smile for the camera! Kalisha was vaguely aware that her hair was standing up, like in some kind of electrical experiment. Dots? Hum. Next, the preacher man was on a TV news show with some other people. One of the other people accused the preacher man of being something. Big words, college words, she was sure Lukey would have understood. And the preacher man was laughing like it was the biggest joke in the world. He had a great laugh. It made you want to laugh along. If you weren't going crazy, that was. Dots. Hum. Each time the Stasi lights came back, they seemed brighter, and each time they seemed to delve deeper into Kalisha's head. In her current state, all the clips that made up the movie were fascinating. They had levers. When the time came, probably tomorrow night, maybe the next, the kids in back half would pull them. "I hate this," Helen said in a small, dismayed voice. "When will it be over?" Preacher Man was standing in front of a fancy mansion where a party seemed to be going on. Preacher Man was in a motorcade. Preacher Man was at an outdoor barbecue, and there was red, white, and blue bunting on the buildings behind him. People were eating corn dogs and big slices of pizza. He was preaching about perverting the natural order of things which God had ordained, but then his voice cut out and was replaced by that of Dr. Hendricks. "This is Paul Weston, kids. His home is in Deerfield, Indiana. Paul Weston, Deerfield, Indiana. Paul Weston, Deerfield, Indiana. Say it with me, boys and girls." Partly because they had no choice, partly because it would bring a merciful end to the colored dots and the rising and falling of the hum, mostly because now they were really into it, the 10 children in the screening room began to chant. Kalisha joined in. She didn't know about the others, but for her, this was the absolute worst part of movie nights. She hated that it felt good. She hated that feeling of levers just waiting to be yanked, begging for it. She felt like a ventriloquist's dummy on that fucking doctor's knee. "Paul Weston, Deerfield, Indiana! Paul Weston, Deerfield, Indiana! Paul Weston, Deerfield, Indiana!" Then Dr. Hendricks came back on the screen, smiling and holding the unlit sparkler. "That's right, Paul Weston, Deerfield, Indiana. Thank you, kids, and have a good night. See you tomorrow." The Stasi lights came back one final time, blinking and swirling and spiraling. Kalisha gritted her teeth and waited for them to be gone, feeling like a tiny space capsule hurtling into a storm of giant asteroids. The hum was louder than ever. But when the dots disappeared, the hum cut off instantly, as if a plug had been pulled on an amplifier.
"They see it," Avery had said. "Was that the missing piece? If so, who was they?"
The screening room lights came up. The doors opened. Jake the Snake on one and Phil the Pill on the other. Most of the kids walked out, but Donna, Len, Hal, and Jimmy sat where they were. Might sit there lolling in the comfortable seats until the caretakers came to shoo them back to their rooms. And one or two, or maybe even all four, might be in Gorky Park after the show tomorrow. The big show, where they did whatever was supposed to be done to the preacher man. They were allowed another half hour in the lounge before being locked in their rooms for the night. Kalisha went there. George, Nikki, and Avery followed. After a few minutes, Helen shuffled in and sat on the floor with an unlit cigarette in her hand and her once bright hair hanging in her face. Iris and Katie came last.
"Headache's better," Katie announced.
"Yes," Kalisha thought. "The headaches get better after the movies, but only for a little while. A shorter little while each time."
"Another fun night at the movies," George muttered.
"All right, children. What have we learned?" Nikki asked. "That somebody somewhere don't much care for the Reverend Paul Weston of Deerfield, Indiana." Kalisha zipped a thumb across her lips and looked at the ceiling.
"Bugs," she thought at Nikki. "Be careful."
Nick put a finger gun to his head and pretended to shoot himself. It made the others smile. It would be different tomorrow, Kalisha knew. No smiles then. After tomorrow's show, Dr. Hendricks would appear with his sparkler lit, and the hum would rise to a white noise roar. Levers would be pulled. There would be a period of unknown length, both sublime and horrible, when their headaches would be banished completely.
instead of a clear 15 or 20 minutes afterward, there might be 6 or 8 hours of blessed relief. And somewhere, Paul Weston of Deerfield, Indiana, would do something that would change his life or end it. For the kids in back half, life would go on, if you could call it living. The headaches would come back, and worse, worse each time, until instead of just feeling the hum, they would become part of it. Just another one of the gorks. That was Avery. No one else could project with such clean strength. It was as if he were living inside her head. That's how it works, Shaw. Because they see it, Kalisha whispered, and there it was. Bingo. The missing piece. She put the heels of her hands against her forehead, not because the headache was back, but because it was so beautifully obvious. She grasped Avery's small, bony shoulder. The gorks see what we see. Why else would they keep them? Nikki put his arm around Kalisha and whispered in her ear. The touch of his lips made her shiver. What are you talking about? Their minds are gone. Like ours will be before long. Avery, that's what makes them stronger. Everything else is gone. Stripped away. They're the battery. All we are is the switch, Kalisha whispered. The ignition switch. Avery nodded. We need to use them. When? Helen Sims' mental voice was that of a small, frightened child. It has to be soon, because I can't take much more of this. None of us can, George said. Besides, right now, that bitch... Kalisha gave her head a warning shake, and George continued mentally. He wasn't very good at it, at least not yet, but Kalisha got the gist. They all did. Right now, that bitch Mrs. Sigsby would be concentrating on Luke. Stackhouse, too. Everyone in the Institute would be, because they all...